extra dimensions in gravity, and we're going to look at the different sort of ways in which extra dimensions crop up. So roughly speaking, the first two lectures, possibly plus epsilon, are going to be on Kaluza-Klein theory, one particular way of having extra dimensions. And then the next two, roughly, are going to be on a different way of having extra dimensions, which is called brain worlds. And then finally, sort of, which is somewhat elastic depending on how, you know, whether we get slowed up, I want to talk about perturbation theory in general relativity. So this week very, very definitely does start pointing towards the final set of courses that you're going to have, which are sort of the explorations courses. So mostly it's sort of catering towards the string theory end with extra dimensions. But when we talk about perturbation theory, some of the concepts there will also feed into the numerical course that you're getting. So hopefully neither of those have been cancelled. So. Right, you've already had a tutorial exploring extra, higher dimensional solutions. I think, was that tutorial 6? Maybe? Last Thursday? So when I derived this curvature tensor for a spherically symmetric space-time, I made remarks at the time about how it would generalize if you had higher dimensional solutions. And so the purpose of that tutorial was taking the simplest possible case, hyperspherically symmetric in four, more than four dimensions. So you should have derived the high dimensional Schwarzschild solution. Actually, sometimes I use capital D, sometimes I use capital N, but it's always a capital letter for the number of space-time dimensions. So in this case, you simply generalize the d omega part to being the metric on a unit d minus 2 sphere. So there's all sorts of different ways you can coordinatize that, which are, you know, not particularly relevant. So as before, this has an event horizon at R plus. And rather like the Schwarzschild solution, you can identify this R plus with the mass of this higher dimensional space-time. So so you can, perhaps the easiest way of seeing this is actually where you do that integral. If you have some sort of very, you know, some extended matter source when you're not actually thinking about the black hole and you're just regarding this as an asymptotic vacuum solution, like we derived m of r was the integral of t naught naught times an appropriate volume factor. This is how you get this. This is another way of getting it. Alternatively, there are other ways of defining mass, and it's actually, if you look at the spatial part of the solution, you kind of look how that falls off as r goes to infinity and pick off the r to the d minus 3 part, which is also this part here. So let's actually look at it in more depth now. So let's play the same tricks that we did for the four-dimensional Schwarzschild solution. So what we're doing here, remember, is we're sending t goes to I tau. And if I just write V as the higher dimensional Schwarzschild potential, and we look at R goes to R plus. And once again, we're going to ask that the tau R part of the metric is non-singular. So, whereas with Schwarzschild, I wrote it obviously out explicitly in terms of 2GM, here I'm just writing this a little more generally so that you could see, in principle at least, how you might define or look for temperatures of, of horizons in general once you've identified them. You tend to just look at derivatives of whatever the metric function is. So as before, we look for some new radial coordinate. So again, we want to write this as d rho squared. So we see that we're going to, that's a square root. Sorry, it's not a square root there. Square root once it goes to rho. So we see we want rho proportional to the square root. We want a factor of 1 over root v primed in rho. And then the 4 is just what makes the numbers actually work. And then if I look at what that tells me about the d tau squared part, then I can see that this r minus r plus here is just simply rho squared times v prime over 4. So that tells me that delta tau is 2 times 2 pi over v primed at r plus. So this gives me my periodicity. So if I now look at what v primed is, well, this is v. So if I take the derivative with respect to r, I'm going to get a factor of minus d minus 3 there. Then I've got r plus to the d minus 3 over r to the d minus 2. So it's, in fact, d minus 3 over R plus when evaluated at R plus. So this tells me that my temperature, which is 1 over beta, so it's V primed over 4 pi, hang on. I've done it the wrong way around, haven't I? Delta tau is V primed over 4 pi. And so V primed is D minus 3, sorry about that, over 4 pi R plus. Got things upside down there. So just as a check for Schwarzschild, what we derived last week, d is 4, so we've got 1 on the top, and then r plus is 2gm, so we've got 1 over 8 pi gm, and that was what we derived last time. let's actually go ahead and compute the entropy. We didn't have time to look at the entropy of the four-dimensional Schwarzschild last week, but we'll derive it now as part of this more general calculation. So for entropy, we're going to need this partition function. So we want to compute the action of the Euclidean Schwarzschild. So remember, this is the integral d tau. The integral over the d minus 2 sphere. Then we've got a root of the metric of the boundary, which we are going to cut off like we did before. And then the extrinsic curvature at that boundary. So once again, we've got our normal. So that's the square root of this Schwarzschild potential times d by dr. So this is what we did last time. This has length 1, because grr downstairs is 1 over v. So all I'm really doing is going through what we did last time, but replacing the four-dimensional Schwarzschild potential with a d-dimensional one. So that tells me that K, which is the divergence of this vector, is 1 over root G. That's 1 over R to the D minus 2. dr of R to the D minus 2 V to the half. So this tells me what my extrinsic curvature is of my Schwarzschild at lambda. So in doing this integral, like before, nothing depends on the angles, nothing depends on time. So I get this factor of beta times the area of the D minus 2 sphere. Now my the square root of the metric on the boundary is, of course, lambda to the d minus 2 times v of lambda square rooted. And then I put in my k lambda here. So if I just multiply through by v to the half, you can see that I'm going to pick up a d minus 2 on r times v here. So if I multiply this out, So the first term is kind of obvious, and the second term is just the derivative of vd. Now, as before, you notice that this has a divergent piece because of this first factor here. When we multiply through by r to the d minus 2, sorry, lambda to the d minus 2, we've got something that's going to blow up as lambda goes to infinity. So as before, we have to subtract off the flat background. So as before, we have that our extrinsic curvature is now just the geometric d minus 2 over r form, but we still have this root v here because we have to rescale our time parameter of flat space to match up the two boundary manifolds that we are integrating over. So we get the same volume factor, but instead we've just got a d minus 2 over lambda. So this volume factor here is just, when you expand it, is going to be 1 minus r plus to the d minus 3 over 2 lambda to the d minus 3. So now you see that when you do the subtraction, that these divergent terms are going to cancel, and then you're just left with all of these r plus to the d minus 3 terms. So, sorry, the factors of lambda cancel because this is lambda to the d minus 3, and here's 1 over lambda to the d minus 3. And then in subtracting these, all I've done is sort of taken, well, here's a d minus d minus 2, this is a plus d minus 3 on 2, and then I've got to add d minus 2 on 2. And so what I end up with, popped over here, so I end up with an expression for the action given in terms of r plus and the periodicity of Euclidean time. And so I've rewritten that as m times beta. So for four-dimensional Schwarzschild, this would mean that you would have m beta over 2, which is what we got for the action. So given the partition function, we can calculate the entropy in terms of its derivative with respect to beta. But we know that log z is just this Euclidean action. So what we're really doing to get the entropy is we're taking the derivative of the mass with respect to beta. But of course, the mass was given in terms of R plus, and we've also calculated the temperature in terms of R plus. So this tells us the dependence of M on beta. So we said that the mass was proportional to this factor R plus to the D minus 3. Then we computed our temperature. So remember, the temperature was D minus 3 over 4 pi R plus. So that tells us that R plus is D minus 3 beta over 4 pi. So this is telling us that the mass is really proportional to beta to the D minus 3. So that tells us that dm by d beta is going to be D minus 3 over beta times m. So if I pop that in here, this is telling me that the entropy is D minus 3 over D minus 2 times beta m. So let me now start unraveling this to see what, you know, this is all very well, but let's sort of try and get this in a form where it means something a bit more, corresponds to something a bit more obvious. M is fine. We know a mass of a black hole, and I suppose given that we strictly speaking know its temperature, but there's another way of expressing this. So we know that the mass is given in terms of the R plus parameter. So if you remember, the mass was proportional to the area times an R plus factor over 16 pi g. There was also D minus 2 in there. And then let me just replace beta again by R plus. So what I've now got, that top line, ought to be something fairly familiar. We've got an area of a D minus 2 sphere times a radius to the D minus 2. So that's the area of the sphere at R equals R plus. So what we've just derived is that entropy is a quarter of the area of an event horizon. (Clears throat) So this was the formula that was conjectured right at the end of the 60s or in the early 70s in order to make black holes consistent with thermodynamics. Question at last. I figured you'd all sort of been out on the town last night. We're a bit too jaded, you know. Yeah.
So the energy compared to the kinetic energy is equals to, but then it doesn't include that anymore. Is that just because the data and fractions are supposed to cancel if you want to?
Well, actually, two dimensions is pretty special for a variety of reasons. So, I mean, I'm strictly a four plus type of a dimensional person. So in two dimensions, there's all sorts of different things that go on with gravity. So it's actually quite interesting. Four dimensions is very special because it is the lowest dimensionality in which gravity can propagate. So, you know, it's essentially the lowest dimension in which we could live. Because, you know, it's sort of the equivalent of Newton's action at a distance, where we can actually feel objects from far away. If you go down a dimension, in 2+1 dimensions, gravity still can act, but space only curves where you actually have a matter source. So you lose the idea of gravitational waves. And then in two dimensions, things that are even stranger still, because in two dimensions, if you look at the Einstein-Hilbert action, then this Ricci scalar is actually a topological invariant if you integrate it over the manifold. So the Einstein-Hilbert action just gives you some geometrical invariant called the Euler characteristic of a two-dimensional manifold. So from the point of view of conventional Einstein gravity, you can't really, it doesn't work in two dimensions. That's not to say that you can't do things in two dimensions, but it's different. You start having to, you know, you usually have dilaton fields. You have to sort of add stuff into your theory. So really, you know, I've been dealing here with the Einstein-Hilbert action and its boundary term. And so the subtext is that I'm not really going to be -2 for this specific, but I didn't actually mention that.
So we should think of higher dimensions.
Yes, lots and lots of them.
So we have our action movement that we're going to lose track of this term of time space, which is clear here because we're short time. I just thought back on. But if we have a more exotic black hole, is it always clear what we subtract? How do we count the things?
I guess in that if you have an analytic solution, yeah, chances are, right, if you're dealing with an analytic solution and you've got something which you have a lot of control over, you also know what is asymptoting far away. So generally speaking, the answer is yes, simply because you're in a situation where you have a lot of control already. So you can directly, you know, you have an analytic solution, it will depend on the number of charges which you can manually turn to zero. So,
I mean, it's clear that cancellation is always actually that we actually get something by
in
our topics and then hopefully by the work.
You're thinking of something completely general.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I think when I first sort of introduced this particular formalism, I kind of put a little bit of a warning sign on it. In that, you know, it's known actually that this isn't from a completely mathematical or rigorous point of view. This is not very well defined because you can make arbitrary definitions of a metric to sort of send this Euclidean action. It's not 100 below, and therefore, you know, when e to the minus action is actually e to the plus something, that's a sign that something's gone wrong. So, I mean, I can't say what would happen in a completely general situation because, you know, I suspect it would probably all go horribly wrong. But from the purpose of analytic solutions, when you've got, in analytic cases, you've got control, you've imposed symmetries on your metrics, so you've actually, you know, you hold the ball of cards, right? So you can do the calculations. So this is doing things explicitly for a very relatively straightforward case. It is a single black hole in an arbitrary number of dimensions, true, but it's a vacuum solution, and it's hyperspherically symmetric, so there's only one charge, which is the mass. But obviously, that's not the only thing you can do. In four dimensions, the most general black hole is called Kerr-Newman, and it was a sort of combination of Rice and Nordstrom, so it had an electromagnetic charge, and Kerr with a rotation. So there are obviously other ways we can generalize this to higher dimensions. We can add charges, fields, gauge fields, and we can include rotation. So I just wanted to give you a sample of other higher dimensional solutions. So the method that I taught you to calculate curvatures in all of these cases, I'm not going to derive these, but in all of these cases you could, depending on, you know, the individual case and your bravery for index, etc. manipulation, you could use that methodology to calculate curvatures and then put it into the Einstein equations or their generalization and confirm that these solutions actually work. So the first one I'd like to tell you about, particularly since you've been taught by both of these characters in the past, is the Myers-Perry set of solutions. Well, actually, Myers and Perry did this high-dimensional Schwarzschild, but I'm trying to remember who actually did it first. I'm not sure it was them, but maybe it was. Apologies, something wrong if it was. So nice thing about what Myers and Perry did, they sort of did this juggernaut of a paper, you know, sort of high-dimensional black hole solutions, where they looked at rotating black holes. So they really just nailed essentially all the vacuum solutions that you could have. So our high-dimensional rotating black hole, this is not the most general one. I'm just giving you one where it's sort of obvious how it's generalized from Kerr. So here, you can see that this looks very, very similar to the Kerr solution. Sort of got the same layout. And I actually need some other piece of stone charge written down here. I'm going to go with some caveats. I'm trying to remember it, and I'm probably going to get it wrong. So just put a little line underneath it, and I will come back. I'll check this out and just come back to you on it. Whether this is R squared or R squared plus A squared, I'm not sure. But it'll be something like that. I'll check it out and come back to you tomorrow on that. Managed to not write it down. Really smart. So as before, we've still got this r theta dependent piece, the rho squared. But now what the equivalent of sort of the Newtonian potential part, the Schwarzschild potential part, you can see that that's pretty much the same, but you've made an obvious generalization to arbitrary dimensions here. So this would have been minus 2gmr for the curve. But 2gmr would be just 2gmr times r squared. And so you can see how you're replacing the 2gm in each case. So this is how it comes in the delta, and you can see that it's sort of replaced there as well. So this is a black hole which is rotating in a single plane. So the general solution has more rotation parameters. So you can think of these as, in any number of dimensions, you can split up the number of dimensions you have into sets of two, and in each plane, you can have some rotation. So in three dimensions, there's only a single sort of spin, or JZ, angular momentum, eigenvalue. In four space dimensions, you can have two commuting eigenvalues for angular momentum, six dimensions, three, so on and so forth. So in higher dimensions, whereas in Kerr you sort of have got only one axis of rotation, in higher dimensions you can have more. So that's why I said this was not the most general rotating black hole. So these guys actually figured that out and figured out how to do it. So another sample solutions. Want to draw to your attention are black hole type of solutions in string theory. So the usual culprits here are Horowitz Strominger. So they kind of wrote the manual on these solutions. And so the idea is that if you look at low energy string theory, lives in 10 dimensions, and it gives you some sort of supergravity in general. And so you can ask, what are the general solutions to this low energy action of string theory? So there are all sorts of charged fields, and there are also different possibilities for, you needn't just have a black hole, you can actually start having different sorts of event horizons. So the reason for thinking about something which isn't just a hole, by a hole I mean it's like something which you can put in a box, which you can surround, then obviously if you're dealing with extended objects such as the fundamental string, then you start becoming used to the idea that the objects that you look for may not be point-like. So it's natural to ask, are there extended solutions? Hmm. So I guess before Horowitz and Strominger wrote their, you know, the textbook paper on the subject, people had already been thinking about extended solutions in gravity. So the very simplest, as a simple example of what I mean by this, you could take the Schwarzschild solution, that's vacuum solution, 4D gravity, and if you manually add on an extra dimension which is flat, this is a solution of 5D gravity. So essentially, just to sort of try and dig a little bit more so that you can see why that is the case, if you imagine that computation of the Kirji tensor using the Cartan formulation, adding on this extra term here, this is just a dz. It's not, when you take d of it, it's going to be zero. So there's no connection of components associated with the z direction, and so no cross terms. So then when you look for any curvature components associated with the z direction, there's absolutely no non-zero thetas with the z in it, so you're going to get no Riemanns with the z in it. So that means there's absolutely no additional curvature associated with adding this extra term in. So if this four-dimensional part is a solution of the vacuum equations, no matter what it is, in this case it's a black hole, if you add an extra direction, then that will also be a solution. So this thing is called a black string, and it just simply, you could sketch it as a cylinder. So that's a simple example of a solution in more than four dimensions, which is a black hole in a more general sense, black hole type solution, and it has an event horizon, but it is not hyperspherical, it's actually cylindrical. So your event horizon now has an extension in the extra dimension. So you needn't just add one.
Yeah. How come it becomes, how come when you stretch out the wall it becomes cylindrical?
Because I just added a dz. So the black, it exists at z equals 0, z equals 1, z equals 10. So it's a cylinder. Z is running along the length. So I needn't just add one direction. Of course, I could add six, in which case it would be a black six brain solution in 10-dimensional Einstein gravity. So, of course, Horowitz and Strominger found much more general solutions. And that's because they were dealing with a much more general action. So depending on which brand of string theory you choose, you get a different sort of effective action. This is just meant to schematically represent what you actually get in string theory. So the differences, if you're going to be doing string type solutions, there are several differences to Einstein gravity that you need to look out for. So the first one is the presence of phi, this scalar. So what this means is that you have to be a bit careful when you vary the action to make sure you take into account this pre-multiplying factor here. So we talked about this when we did Brown-Zdicky theory. So that's just the first difference, but it's a bit different, but you've met it before. Then the other thing is the presence of additional fields. So strings are charged under a two-form field, BAB, which gives rise to a three-form field strength. So that's what that H is. So just like point particles are charged under electromagnetism, in that case, you think of crudely speaking, you think of a charged particle as having an A0. If you've got now something with not just time component, but a length component, you kind of need two legs, two indices in your gauge field to mop up the dimensions of your object, your world sheet in this case. So this thing has an electric charge under this gauge field. And then finally, these gauge fields are other fields which can crop up. So these, as I've written them down, actually crop up in either type 2A or 2B supergravity, and they're known as Ramond-Ramond fields. So just to give you a couple of example solutions, so what happened, this is where you're just taking the first part of the action. You're looking for a solution with a non-zero H. And in rather like the Reissner-Nordström solution, where you took, I think you've certainly looked at a case where you had an F theta phi. Here, this is the area form on a three sphere. So this would be the equivalent of sine squared chi sine theta d chi cross d theta dot d phi, for example. So it's the area form on a three sphere. And so here, this is sort of like an analog of a magnetic monopole solution, except where you've got this three-form charge. So notice that this extra part here is just completely flat. Also, notice if R plus equals R minus, this is what's known as an extremal solution, then the dt squared part is also flat. And you can sort of rejig your r coordinate to make that completely non-singular too, so that your geometry looks something like, very good at sketching this, where that kind of goes on forever. So this has a completely non-singular extremal limit. That's the five brain solution. Yep.
Can you do something by taking a 2 plus 1 black hole and adding, as mentioned, you get a kind of 3 plus 1 dimensional black hole?
I'm going to have a 2 plus 1 dimensional black hole in straight Einstein gravity. Need a negative cosmological constant to get a 3D black hole. What I said doesn't work when you've got a cosmological constant. So you need it to be vacuum. In three dimensions, 2 plus 1 dimensions, the equivalent of a Schwarzschild solution is something where you've got an isolated mass. And that's in 2 plus 1 dimensions, an isolated mass gives a conical deficit. So what you said is true, you can add an extra dimension for the equivalent there, but then what you get in 3 plus 1 dimensions is a line with a conical deficit, and that's called an extreme. So it's the same thing, but it's just not a black hole in that case. So if I look at a 6 brain, and I'll put D in front of it because its extremal limit is indeed a D brain, then I'm going to say that this is now going to have one of these Legendre-Mond fields excited. So this looks a bit like our monopole type of field strength. So in this case, if I take an extremal limit, what I get now is the square root of 1 minus r plus on r here, 1 over that for the r squared piece. I've got, again, the square root there, same as the t squared piece. And I've got, I've got a factor of r minus r plus in front of the omega squared. So let me just rewrite that down and make a couple of comments on it before finishing. So what I want you to notice here, again, this is simply looking forward to things from, you know, through the string theory. Notice this thing is now completely Lorentz invariant in 6 plus 1 dimensions. So this is the brain directions, the 6 brain in this case. And H is a harmonic function in 4 dimensions, the only tone potential. And you've sort of got, again, this pattern of, you know, square roots of harmonic functions, which keep cropping up. So just to sort of wrap up and point forward, this is just meant to give you a flavor of the different types of solutions that you can get at higher dimensional gravity. Of course, these are all idealized. The extra dimensions are non-compact. Here we're living in 10 non-compact dimensions, whereas we kind of feel that we'd know about it if there were more than 4 non-compact dimensions. So what we're going to move on to for the next 3 lectures is looking at ways in which we can have extra dimensions but not see them. So there's essentially 2 ways of doing that. One is making them small, so small that we basically just ignore them. And the other way is using these idea of brains and actually gluing ourselves onto some submanifold. So you're sort of going to see that the techniques that we've been developing coming into play in these 2 particular ways of hiding extra dimensions. Sort of doing Kaluza-Klein, seeing how that gives you something like Einstein gravity, and also doing things with brains, looking at submanifolds, and seeing how that also can give you things under certain circumstances that look like Einstein gravity.